people like me, and you always get these references to Chesterton. He was a huge influence on Lewis becoming a Christian. So was he a great spiritual influence upon Tolkien, upon Charles Williams, upon Dorothy Sayers, all that group of people over in England in the mid-20th century. He was also a huge influence on people that didn't hang around with C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot, Evelyn Waugh, all kinds of famous 20th century people with a Christian influence on the world were influenced by this man, G.K. Chesterton. And part of his influence came from what his nickname refers to. He's referred to as the Prince of Paradox. And what's so interesting about him is that Chesterton has a way of explaining what it is you think. He'll say, here's what you're thinking. You say, right, right. And then he will show you that you're wrong. And not just wrong, but totally wrong. He'll show you that what's actually true is not just something different, but something totally opposite to what you thought was the truth. He's called the Prince of Paradox. I started, in my own mind, calling him the Master of the Meaningful Contradiction, because there are many times when there are contradictions in life, and he can show you the meaning in them, and that's a very helpful thing. He said things. He wrote things. He wrote thousands of articles and thousands of paragraphs. He wrote a lot and a lot of books. He said, for example, I love this. He said, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. That's a Chesterton thing. He said surprising things. He says, I am ordinary in the correct sense of the term, which means the acceptance of an order. And then he talked about the order he accepted. A creator and the creation, the common sense of gratitude for creation, life and love as gifts permanently good, marriage and chivalry as laws rightly controlling them. I'm ordinary in the correct sense of the term, which means the acceptance of an order. There he is. He's explaining to us that to be ordinary is an extraordinary thing. And he was extraordinarily under the order that comes to us from taking the Bible and Jesus Christ seriously. He could see through the so-called wisdom of the world, and he called the wise people of the world on it. So he became very good friends with H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, who were the leading atheists of his time, by challenging them to public debate, by meeting in front of thousands of people and debating these guys, and winning them over by his wit, his humor, his charm, his ability to laugh at themselves, while showing that their arguments against God were exactly the opposite of the truth. We need someone like that to take on Richard Dawkins and Chris Hitchens and these people whose bestsellers make a mockery of Christianity. But we don't seem to have a G.K. Chesterton these days. Too bad for us. He could see through the so-called wisdom of the world. He took on the people who said that they were impartial about religion. He said, impartiality is a pompous name for indifference, which is an elegant name for ignorance. So you say you're impartial about the things of religion, but you're really just indifferent. You say you're indifferent, but you're just ignorant. If you knew more, you'd be less indifferent. You'd be less impartial. He was a man with a great love of life. He was fun. He was a funny guy and a fun guy. He said, in regard to loving all of life, an inconvenience is only an adventure wrongly considered. An adventure is an inconvenience rightly considered. I thought about that on Monday afternoon of the youth group canoe trip when I really messed everything up. It's all my fault. It was a huge delay getting to the lake. And it was a huge inconvenience what I did to that rented van. But it was an adventure, if rightly considered. And that's here's a way to love life. See all the inconveniences as the beginning of an adventure. He did that. He was like that. Now, you need to know as well, and some of you want me to get to this, that some years after becoming a famous person, well known to be a Christian, G.K. Chesterton entered the Roman Catholic Church. So you gotta know, listening to an Alliance pastor, Protestant minister, that there's a whole lot about G.K. Chesterton's view of Christianity that I just don't agree with at all. So, like looking at Edwards last week, this is not, me saying, you gotta start believing this if you wanna be comfortable here. There's lots to disagree with. But learning about Christ and knowing Christ from a person that you wouldn't normally listen to can be a very valuable experience. That's what I found after years and years of ignoring Chesterton once I started reading his thoughts. Chesterton said once that he distrusted hard, cold, thin people. I'm kind of a thin people. And I can be cold-blooded and hard-hearted. So he would not have trusted me And I find that reading him is good for my soul because it teaches me not to trust myself and all of my instinctive ideas about what's right. And he shows me the meaningful contradictions in what I believe and challenges me to not be so cold and hard and thin about what I believe. He would have despised everything that Jonathan Edwards stood for, and Jonathan Edwards has been a great hero of mine. So it's really a good balancing thing for me to go to this big, fat Catholic and learn about knowing Christ. And shame on me for all those years, and shame on any of you while we're at it, for ignoring someone who has so much to teach us about knowing Christ because he doesn't agree with us on all the details of our faith. He had many brilliant things to say about Jesus Christ, especially in this book, The Everlasting Man. And I've learned to benefit from him like I've learned to benefit from a number of other people that I am in stark contrast with, according to something that's called the principle of first purposes. You know, you don't go to Jonathan Edwards to learn how to be funny in the pulpit. He was not a funny guy. But you could go to Spurgeon to learn about fitting humor into your Christianity, and you could go to Chesterton to learn about fitting humor and a great big jovial fat love of life into your Christianity, because he was that. So you look at what a person is good for, and you call that the first purposes, pay attention to that, and let alone the stuff that you don't agree with. I've learned that. Look for the main thing about a person that you can benefit from. And here's the main thing that you can benefit from reading G.K. Chesterton on, and this is what we get to this morning. The foundation of the point this morning is that knowing Christ is knowing the ultimate human being, knowing the everlasting man. And understanding how to know Christ from the perspective of the Prince paradoxes leads us to this application of the main point. Knowing Christ means believing a great wealth of apparently contradictory truths about Jesus Christ. Knowing Christ involves believing a great wealth. It's not a problem, this is a good thing. A great wealth of apparently contradictory truths about Jesus Christ. Now, you should be prepared for that, because as a person who knows Christ in a personal way, you already believe that he is both human being and God. And those two truths, which are totally true, are in contradiction to each other, right? Because to be a human being is to be a creature, not the creator. But he is the creator. And to be God means you're not a part of creation, but he is a part of the creation. So we're already, you know, just by believing that Jesus is both God and man, we're already into the marketplace of holding together truths that seem to contradict each other or even do contradict each other. And someone like Chesterton can just, in a big, fat, happy way, take on the contradiction and show the beauty of the thing and make you richer for it. So with that in mind, with the idea in mind that we're going to have to load up our tray with a whole lot of ideas that actually seem to be in contradiction to each other, and in some cases are in contradiction to each other, let's get on with knowing Christ. Our text this morning is John chapter 1, verses 14 to 18, and here we go. Let me read these for you. Here's John chapter 1, referring to Jesus as the Word. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Referring to John the Baptist, the gospel says, John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. And then the gospel goes on. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. This is the text that we look at mostly this morning. And let's notice from the very beginning that there are a number of truths that seem to contradict each other, and in some cases do. Now, here's an example. Verse 18, no one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Well, the only God who's at God's side is Jesus Christ. He has made him known. So he has seen him, and yet no one has ever seen God. And the contradiction gets thicker as you pay attention to the details and read through the Gospel of John. You get to chapter 6. Jesus says, not that anyone has seen the Father except he who is from God. He has seen the Father. So someone has seen the Father. Jesus Christ has seen the Father. a human being has seen the Father. And it gets thicker. In John chapter 14, one of the apostles, Philip, says to Jesus, "Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough for us." And Jesus said to him in a rebuking sort of way, and to the other disciples as well, "Have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." How can you say, "Show us the Father"? You've already seen the Father, he says. And yet we read at the beginning that no one has seen God. So what do you do about that? Digest it? Bask in it? Catch on to the fact that if you have the opportunity to come to know Christ, who is both God and man, you are wading out into the depths of truth that are so complicated that your mind is going to get boggled. So don't say, "Oh, this is getting mind-boggling," as if that's a bad thing. Say, "Oh, this is getting mind-boggling. This is a good thing." You're beginning to tangle with the truths about the infinite God and his infinitely wonderful Son, Jesus Christ. So there's a contradiction in our text, but it's not the one I was really aiming at. I missed. Here's the one I was aiming at. Example number two. Contradictions are built into the text. From verse 14, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we've seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." And then you get to verse 17. "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." And I want you to see this morning, from what those words imply, that it is a marvelously paradoxical experience to get to know Jesus Christ. And you should brace yourself for the apparent contradiction, for the paradox involved in being a happy Christian. We should be prepared to have to tangle with truth against truth, and truth that doesn't seem to fit with truth, because, well, the words of Jesus give us the experience of it from the beginning. I mean, if you know anything about what Jesus has commanded us, you'll know. He said, "The first shall be last, but the last shall be first," right? He said, if you want to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, make yourself the slave of everyone. It's the slave who's the greatest. And we should be, you know, getting used to the fact from how Jesus taught us that things aren't what they seem. They're exactly the opposite. The guy in last place is coming in first. The slave is the great one. The great one is not the greatest one. The first is last. And it goes on. Jesus explained really clearly. If you want real life, you've got to die with Christ. The path to life is the path of the cross, the path of death. Jesus said, if you want to save your life, too bad for you, you're going to lose it. It's the one who loses his life who's going to save it. We have all of these contradictions served up to us as we seek to understand what it means to know Christ. And we need to brace ourselves for that, and do more than brace ourselves. We need to open our minds to the fact that we're going to have these great, big, important truths we must hold on to, that from all sorts of angles, don't fit together, don't make sense, don't get along, can't both be true, but are. And getting really practical, based on what we see in John chapter 1, I want to show you the reality of that. So here's a statement that you need to really take to heart as you digest John chapter 1. Here's a blank to fill in if you're taking notes. Knowing Christ is, leave some space and then say, a demanding relationship. And you leave some space for the adjective of your choice. Is a very demanding relationship. Is an intensely demanding relationship. Here's the best one. If you know the actual meaning of the word, is an excruciatingly demanding relationship. This is along the lines of Chesterton saying, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. You know, most people's problem with Christianity, he says, is that they saw that it was going to be hard, so they decided not to volunteer. And they're right to think it's hard, because knowing Christ is a demanding relationship. And you see that from John chapter 1, where we read that the only Son from the Father is full of truth. Full of grace and truth. Leave grace alone for a minute, we'll get back to it. He's full of truth. And truth comes through Jesus Christ. Now, one of the ways that the Gospel of John explains that the truth comes from Jesus Christ because he's full of truth is the imagery of light. You get it in John chapter 1. It says, verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And later on in the Gospel of John, that gets very personal. Jesus stood up one time in the temple with many lanterns lit all over the sanctuary of the temple, and he said, John chapter 8, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. John says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. There is a conflict in the world because Jesus has come into the world. It's the conflict between light and darkness, which is the conflict between knowledge and ignorance, or truth and falsehood. Jesus is full of truth. He is the light. He's full of knowledge. He's full of what's right and what's wrong. Error, darkness, does not like all that he is. The more clearly we see Christ, the more clearly he's revealed to us, the more brightly the truth shines from him. So you get this clearest view of Christ in the book of the Revelation, which is a revelation from Jesus Christ, and largely a revelation of Jesus Christ. And John, who wrote the gospel, then writes the revelation after he receives it. And look at these words in John chapter 1. Here's a picture of Christ as he really is. He says, in the midst of the lampstands, he saw one like a son of man. This is Jesus, clothed with a long robe. And there's nothing very alarming about that. And with a golden sash around his chest, and that's not very alarming either. The hairs of his head were white like wool, as white as snow. That's a little alarming. His eyes were like a flame of fire. That's really alarming. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. His voice was like the roar of the ocean. That's really alarming. In his right hand, he held seven stars. And from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. To look at Jesus with the sword of the truth coming from his mouth and his eyes blazing is like looking at the sun. It's too bright. He's too bright. He's too radiant with light to look at. So no one looks. They fall on their face. They cover themselves. Because no one can see God, and he is God. He's so full of truth. The truth came into the world, and the darkness has not overcome it, though the darkness has tried. Jesus is the one we saw last week who loves righteousness. His truth is what he loves. He loves the truth. He loves what's right. He loves righteousness. He hates wickedness. And we mean to have a relationship with him, so we got a problem. Because we do not hate wickedness. We kind of like it. We rent movies with wickedness in it because it's kind of cool to watch. And we do not love righteousness. We get alarmed by totally righteous conduct and behavior and the demands of the law. And that's our problem. It's the problem that's outlined in the Gospel of John. Being a person who knows Christ is to be in a very demanding relationship because it's to know Jesus Christ, who is full of truth. And John says in chapter 3, this is the judgment. Here's what's the trouble for us. The light has come into the world. Jesus Christ has come into the world. And people love the darkness rather than the light because their deeds are evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light lest his deeds should be exposed. We have this conflict involved in the center of coming to know Christ because we've got within us remnants of the darkness that hate the light, and Jesus is full of truth. He's full of light, so radiant that you can't even look on him, and he calls us to himself, and we want to be close to him because we love him and we mean to love him more, but the darkness does not love him, and we have darkness within our souls and our hearts, which means that to be at peace with God through Christ, to be at peace with Christ means being at war with ourselves, with our own sinfulness, with our own selfishness, with our own worldliness, with our love of the world, with our own laziness. To be at peace with God through Jesus Christ, to be at peace with Christ means to be at war with ourselves, and it means to be at war with the world, and it means to be at war with the darkness, the forces of darkness, with Satan, the world, the flesh, and the devil. These are all our enemies. If God is our friend, it's war, and it's hard work. It's war, and it's the worst kind of hard, it's the worst kind of war, the bloodiest kind of war. It's civil war. It's us at war with ourselves. It's the north against the south, or the blue against the gray, or something. It's civil war. You've got to fight your own tendency to stay away from God in order to get to God. It's a very demanding relationship. It's hard. It's brutal. It's painful. And it's deadly. In fact, Jesus made it really clear when he was talking in all those contradictory ways about if you love your life, you'll lose it. If you try to save your life, you'll lose it. If you lose your life, you'll save it. He said, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must say no to himself. He must deny himself. And he must take up his cross, his death instrument, and follow me. To follow Christ, you got to sign on to die. You got to take up your cross, which is the obedience to God that kills, right? When Jesus took up his cross, he was saying yes to the will of God, and he went off and died. To follow Christ is to agree to be dead, to agree to be killed. And it's a voluntary thing. You take up your cross and go off and die the death of obedience to God, knowing Christ is an excruciatingly demanding relationship. And excruciatingly is based on the word cross. It means the pain of crucifixion. So that's a perfect word. It's an excruciatingly difficult relationship. But hey, this is G.K. Chesterton Sunday. We got contradictions here. So point two, equally vital to grasp. Knowing Christ is, leave some room for an adjective, an easy relationship. I mean an adverb. Leave room for another. Is an intensely easy relationship. Is a wonderfully easy relationship. Is a heavenly easy relationship. It really is. Why? Well, we've got John chapter 1 in front of us, where Jesus is referred to as the only Son from the Father. This is verse 14, full of grace and truth. He's full of truth. He's equally full of grace. And we get to verse 16, and John says, to all of us who have received Christ, from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Verse 17, for the law was given through Moses, and that was a wonderful help to know God. But grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Not just truth, but grace. We've all received grace. If you're a follower of Christ, if you've entered into this demanding relationship, if you've taken up your cross and agreed to die, agreed to obey God to the death, then you've received grace from him. And you know what he does for people who have received his grace, his undeserved help? You know what he adds to the life of those who have received grace? It's there in verse 16. He adds grace. Grace upon grace. More and more undeserved favor. More and more help. So he who calls you to this deadly experience of knowing Christ is full of grace. And we've all received grace. And grace upon grace. For he's full of grace. So, Paul the Apostle says to the Corinthians, because he thinks you already know this, you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, rich in truth, rich in holiness, rich in the love of righteousness, rich in his freedom from wickedness, though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you and me and everyone who acknowledges him as Lord, God and man, all of us might become rich. We are rich in Christ as we believe in him because he became poor. That's the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. And Jesus himself spoke of what an easy thing it is to follow him. He said to a whole lot of tired, burdened people in Matthew chapter 11, he said, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And then, in a paradoxical way, an apparent contradiction, offering rest to the laboring and the heavy laden, he says, take my yoke upon you. And a yoke is a great big piece of wood, a big heavy piece of wood. And in Bible language, in Bible imagery, it is the symbol of slavery, the yoke of slavery. So he says, take my yoke upon you, which is sign on as my slave, which is give up all your rights and all your weekends, all your time off. Be my slave. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. We say, well, that sounds good, because I'm burdened, I'm heavy laden, I'm laboring, I need rest. So thanks for the offer of rest. But where does taking up the yoke of slavery fit in here? And Jesus says, my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. And you say, it doesn't sound very easy, it doesn't sound very light, and it's not, because the yoke that you actually take upon yourself is the cross that you take up, that is the commitment to obey. The yoke is a symbol of slavery. It's a commitment to be the willing slave of Jesus. Do everything your master says. And your master is full of truth. He's got demands. He loves righteousness. He insists that you be righteous. He hates wickedness. He insists that you stop being wicked. So it's a big demanding thing to take up the yoke. It's a painful thing. It's the cross. It's crucifixion. So you're wondering, how is it easy? How is the load light? Well, think about it. Think about it. It's easy and light, relatively speaking. Better to be the busy slave of Christ than anyone else's slave. Or would you rather remain enslaved to your own appetites, and your own lusts, and your own sinfulness? Or enslaved to the world? Enslaved to the Joneses that you're trying to keep up with? Or enslaved to the rats that you're racing with? Or enslaved to anyone or anything else? Relatively speaking, far better to be Christ's slave than anyone else's slave. And not just relatively, but absolutely. To know Christ through a commitment of trust and obedience, to believe in Christ, is a liberating thing. You get freed from the guilt of your sin. That'll be a relief. You get freed from the power of sin. That will be a pleasure. Eventually, you get freed from the presence of sin. That will be heaven. It's easy. It's a light load. So come to Christ. Be done laboring for anyone else other than him. Be done carrying around any other load, and labor for him and carry around the load of obligation to be his servant, and you won't find it hard. You'll find it easy. While Jesus said those words in Matthew chapter 11, our man John, who wrote the Gospel of John and received the revelation, was there on hand. And when he was an old man, after years and years of experience, he wrote these words in his 1 John letter, chapter 5. He said, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. Take on the commandments, which you can neatly summarize as love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and love your neighbors yourself. And you could say there's just two commandments. Or you could get detailed and realize there's dozens of commandments packed in there. But John, who tried real hard to get it right, said, it's not burdensome. It's easy. Load is light. You're going to like it. And if you've tried it a little bit and you're hesitant to keep trying more because it's hard, embrace the contradiction. The harder you try, the easier it gets. The easier you take it, the harder it is. Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and not tried, or not tried very much. So come to Christ, who, as the perfect human being, is everything a human being could be that's good, but perfectly so. He's perfectly patient. He's perfectly kind. He's perfectly helpful. He's perfectly wise. He's perfectly knowledgeable about what you really need. And he's perfectly committed to your joy and your peace. We're ready for an application. So here we go. Some blanks to fill in if you're interested. Here's the application. Make your life easier. Make your life easier and simpler by striving with all your heart to know Christ. Now there you got a meaningful contradiction. You can make your life a lot easier than it is. I can make my life a lot simpler than it is if I will strive more wholeheartedly to know Christ. You can see this as doing yourself the everlasting favor of getting closer to the everlasting man. Do yourself the long-lasting, the infinite favor of getting to be in a relationship of real knowledge, getting to be at peace with the infinite man, with the everlasting man, and serve him as his willing and happy slave, and your life will be easier, and your life will be simpler, because you've added to every other demand and every other tiring thing and every other challenge this great, big, demanding, tiring thing of taking up your cross and saying yes to God, whatever the pain, whatever the shame, whatever the death. Make your life easier and simpler by striving with all your heart to know Christ. Now, what we've already seen, just to be clear, is that knowing Christ comes down to trusting him enough to obey him and trust him enough to serve him. So serving him wholeheartedly and obeying him wholeheartedly is how you know him. And the more you do that, the more wholeheartedly you do that, which is a very hard and demanding thing to do, the easier and the simpler your life will be. And you will be a joyful, peaceful, living contradiction. You know, people who get to know you and get to know you on the inside will say, never seen a person so serious about following Christ in every detail of life, and I've never seen anyone more at peace with the circumstances. And someone will say, how could that be true? You know, because like to be at peace with your circumstances, you just got to stop caring about things. And considering the superiority of Christianity, you'd say, well, you know, that's the Buddhist way, to try to deny yourself all your desires and get into a place of perfect peace. But the everlasting man says, no, no, no. Perfect peace comes from loading yourself up with all the demands of the infinitely holy God who loves righteousness and hates wickedness. And you could be that living contradiction too, which means you could help people come to know where the real peace and the real joy is found. And it all comes to us because he who is infinitely rich became poor, that we through his poverty might become rich. And he doesn't want us to forget that. So he invented a little ceremony, which we call the Lord's Supper. And he invites us to eat and to drink from the Lord's table and to remember the price that he paid to make this easy life of carrying the light burden a reality to us.